The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast. Presentations and interviews with leading attorneys and industry professionals. On this edition, Peter Sullivan and Maureen McGurl on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in American Needle versus the NFL. The opinions expressed by guests interviewed on LexisNexis Legal Podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of Reed Elsevier Incorporated, LexisNexis, subsidiary companies, shareholders, employees, or customers, and should not be considered legal advice. On May 24, 2010, in a unanimous opinion, the Supreme Court issued a decision that's garnered a good deal of press. American Needle versus National Football League addressed the issue of whether professional sports leagues should be considered a single entity for purposes of Section 1 of the Sherman Act. This is a key issue. Should sports teams be deemed a single economic unit, they would be considered incapable of conspiring to restrain trade in violation of the Sherman Act. This would mean that without violating the antitrust laws, they could engage in all sorts of joint activity that otherwise would be considered collusive and potentially illegal. All seemed to agree that the court's ruling in American Needle was narrow. It considered only one aspect of joint activity between the NFL teams, joint licensing of their respective intellectual property. The NFL teams had created a joint venture to collectively license each team's logos for shirts and hats. With respect to this, the court ruled that the NFL's licensing activities constituted concerted action that is not categorically beyond the coverage of Section 1 of the Sherman Act. While the court clearly did not hold that the NFL's joint licensing activity violated the Sherman Act, only that it was to be judged under the rule of reason, it held that concerted activity was present and that there was no Sherman Act immunity for it. There's been a good deal of debate about exactly the extent of the reach of American Needle. Is it really a groundbreaking decision? What does it mean for professional sports? What does it mean for joint ventures generally? Well, now that the dust has settled somewhat, we have two well-known commentators to revisit American Needle. Maureen McGurl is in private practice in New York and one of the co-authors of the second edition of Antitrust Laws and Trade Regulation, published by Matthew Bender. She's practiced in the antitrust and complex litigation fields for more than 30 years. Peter Sullivan is one of the other co-authors of this leading treatise. Peter is also co-chair of the antitrust practice group at Gibson Dunn. He's been practicing antitrust law for more than 30 years. Peter and Maureen have written on the scope of the Supreme Court's ruling in emerging issue analysis pieces that are available from LexisNexis. Joining Peter and Maureen is LexisNexis legal editor John Rack, who's also the editor of Antitrust Laws and Trade Regulation, the book authored by Peter and Maureen.
Peter, Maureen, thank you very much for your time and for being part of this LexisNexis legal podcast. I know you have a number of questions for each other. Maureen, why don't you begin?
Peter, what was the significance for the professional sports industry of the decision that the NFL and its member teams had engaged in concerted activity?
Well, first let me say that I think it was a big deal for professional sports. The question before the Supreme Court was, in essence, whether the NFL was capable of conspiracy under Section 1 of the Sherman Act. And the Supreme Court answered that in the affirmative, yes, that they were. And I think up until that time, the NFL and professional sports were hoping that there would be some extensive immunity provided by the Supreme Court from the antitrust laws. And clearly the Supreme Court has said no, the professional sports are not immune from the antitrust law simply because they engage in a common effort to promote sports. And it blows apart the notion that I think the professional sports had been operating under, that the fact that you need to have cooperation to produce professional sports gives them some special rights under the antitrust laws. And as I said, the Supreme Court has said the necessity of cooperation does not turn concerted activity into independent action. So I think it is quite significant in terms of how the professional sports leagues had viewed themselves. I don't think it necessarily is a terribly significant decision when it comes down to viewing the antitrust laws, but for sports, it is. Maureen, let me ask you a question. Do you think that the court announced some new test to cover its analysis?
I don't believe the Supreme Court announced a new test. Like you, I think the American Needle opinion constituted a very firm direction to lower courts not to ignore the question of whether there is concerted action because the challenged conduct has pro-competitive benefits or may have legitimate business justifications. Also, some lower courts have found joint efforts involved a single entity simply because the participants shared a common purpose. It would be rather surprising to see competitors engage in any cooperative activity if they did not share at least one common purpose, and that purpose could be purely anti-competitive, such as fixing or increasing prices. The Supreme Court's opinion gave examples of the use of joint ventures to carry out illegal acts. While no new test was announced, I think the Supreme Court decision really mandates that courts give more focus to the question or the joint activity prong of a Section 1 violation than many had in the past. Peter, do you think that any new tests were announced in American Needle?
No, I don't. Clearly, you know, because American Needle comes from the Supreme Court, it's a noteworthy decision. Any Supreme Court decision is. But I don't find it precedent-setting or no really surprising. And while it's true that the court clarified, as you mentioned, Maureen, the meaning of conspiracy and the language of Section 1, I don't think its reading of the Sherman Act is anything but a reaffirmation of the existing tests that it had used and articulated over the decades, really. For example, no one would dispute that the court years ago in the BMI case did away with formalistic line drawing. That has been a thing of the past. You don't look simply at structures or forms to determine whether something is a violation of antitrust laws. And that's been the law since at least 1979 when the BMI case came out. It's equally, in my mind, long established that Section 1 liability doesn't turn on the fact that parties are separate entities. So there's no formalistic line drawing. And just because the parties who are being reviewed or their conduct being reviewed are separate legal entities doesn't mean that they automatically violate Section 1 of the Sherman Act. You know, that's the Copperwell decision. And Copperwell, you know, was 1984, so that's, you know, 21 years ago that we've had that decision and that view of the Supreme Court. Applying Section 1 to joint ventures and holding that joint ventures are not immune from the antitrust laws is not novel. You have the NCAA case being handed down in 1984, which applied the Sherman Act to the NCAA. And there's a lot of other precedent, obviously, that deals with that topic. And I guess I'm always surprised about how professional sports reacted to American Needle, because there's been many, many cases that have applied Section 1 to sports. So the sports team should not be surprised that Section 1 applies to them. And I agree with your analysis, Maureen. I think that there is no new test defined. It's maybe an articulation, maybe better than they have had in past years, but it's just an articulation of existing tests.
Peter, do you think there's any area in which a professional sports league still might be considered outside the reach of Section 1?
Well, that's an interesting question, because not all sports leagues are treated equally under the antitrust laws, believe it or not. Baseball, for example, has long held an exemption from the antitrust laws. That goes back decades, to the 20s, I think. And it appears that the Supreme Court has had a special place in its heart for baseball. Now, Congress has taken a little bit of that away by the Curt Flood Act of 1998 and made baseball more subject to the antitrust laws. But still, baseball as a professional sport has a vaulted place in the antitrust laws, which will probably never be changed unless Congress decides to change it. But getting to your question, there are other exemptions that apply to professional sports. There's no broad brush exemption such as baseball. But, for example, the NFL is exempted under 15 U.S.C. 1291 to 1292, which provides that it can pool and sell unitary video packages to TV networks. So there are these special exemptions to the antitrust laws, and then and the NFL can also use blackouts as a way to basically encourage people to go games, to go to games, and force people actually to go to games if they want to see them. Another area that I think is exempt under the antitrust laws for professional sports, and for everyone for that matter, is collective bargaining. And one of the key questions I think that sports will face is how American Needle affects collective bargaining. But there are both statutory and non-statutory exemptions for collective bargaining. The statutory, of course, is under the Norris LaGuardia Act, and the non-statutory was set by the Supreme Court. And that one is interesting because it exempts collective bargaining agreements if the parties limit the collective bargaining to situations that impact them and them alone. It deals with what they agree upon deals with the matter subject to collective bargaining agreements in general. And there's arm's length negotiations. So there are areas out there that are clearly exempt from the antitrust laws and are outside of Section 1. Now, the real issue, of course, is what's going to happen to the areas that fall in between, and that's the $50 million question. Clearly, scheduling is going to be something I think that's going to be outside of the Section 1 of the Sherman Act and the like. Maureen, let me ask you then a question. Exactly how far do you think that the court's decision can be stretched outside of the NFL and professional sports?
The American Needle decision was not on what constitutes concerted activity. Was not limited to the sports industry, and I think it is of general applicability to all industries. So I think that it's a decision that should be reviewed by everyone who's giving advice under the antitrust laws.
You know, I note, Maureen, that there's been some discussion as to whether American Needle creates concerns for joint ventures that are fully integrated joint ventures. A couple questions there for you. First, how does a fully integrated joint venture differ from the joint venture created by the NFL, which was subject to American Needle?
Well, a prior decision by the Supreme Court, the Texaco v. Dogger case, I think provides a good example of a fully integrated joint venture. In that case, each of the two oil companies had contributed all of its gasoline and distribution assets to the joint venture, and the two oil companies no longer competed in selling gasoline. The joint venture continued to distribute gasoline under the brands Shell and Texaco, which were the two companies that had formed the joint venture. And the price of both Shell and Texaco branded gasoline was the same. Because the joint ventures had pooled their capital and shared the risk loss and no longer competed with each other, the court regarded decisions of the joint venture and its owners on the prices to be charged by the joint venture as little more than price setting by a single entity. So the court found there was no per se illegal price fixing when the joint venture set prices. Now in American Needle, the NFL joint venture, NFL Properties, differed in a very important respect. The NFL teams had not contributed their intellectual property to NFLP. NFLP licensed that property, but each team retained ownership of its trademarks and logos. And the teams remained potential competitors in licensing their trademarks to sportswear manufacturers. And indeed, one team, the Dallas Cowboys, in fact, licensed its logos and trademarks separately. And that, I think, was a key to the finding that decisions by the NFLP on licenses involved concerted activity by the team members who had formed it. American Needle has not ended the rule that a fully integrated joint venture will be found to be a single entity. A very recent decision by a district court in Stanislaus Food Products versus USS Pasco Industries, which was decided on September 3, involved allegations that USS Pasco had fixed the price of tin-plated steel it sold. And USS Pasco was a joint venture formed in 1986 by two former competitors who contributed their operating facilities and capital to the joint venture and shared control of and profits of the joint venture. After forming the joint venture, the two competitors ceased selling tin-plated steel and no longer participated in the market. Also, apparently, they had agreed not to re-enter the market. As a result, the district court ruled that this joint venture was a single entity and dismissed allegations that the partners and the joint venture had conspired to fix the price of products sold by the joint venture.
Well, moving outside of integrated joint ventures, Maureen, do you think that American Needle creates concerns for companies reaching agreements with an entity that it partially owns, such as partially owned subs or affiliates?
I think American Needle will lead courts to more carefully analyze situations where the subsidiary is not 100% owned. The Supreme Court stated that determinations of whether there is a complete unity of interest must be based on competitive realities, not merely legal structure. It also said the courts had to focus on whether there were independent centers of decision making and suggested that courts should consider whether the owners are actual or potential competitors of the parent or subsidiary, whether the interests of all the owners are completely aligned, and who makes day-to-day operational decisions for the subsidiary. And I think the court also indicated that where decisions require the assent of more than a mere majority of shareholders, concerted action is more likely to be found. I think the real result of American Needle is that there will be fewer bright line rules in determining whether a parent and its partially owned subsidiary are legally capable of conspiring under Section 1.
Now, I was reading the government's amicus brief, and the Solicitor General who submitted that brief is now Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. And it's interesting to note that in the amicus brief, the government argued that entities should not be considered capable of conspiracy under Section 1 if they have effectively merged, to underscore effectively merged, the relevant aspects of their operations, which would eliminate actual or potential competition in that area. And more importantly, the restraint under review does not significantly affect either actual or potential competition outside of the merged operations. Now, Maureen, do you think the Supreme Court adopted the government's test that it articulated in the amicus brief? And did the court indicate whether it was likely to adopt one in the future now that we have Supreme Court Justice Kagan in May?
Well, in a footnote, the Supreme Court stated there was no need to, quote, pass on the government's position in order to resolve the case. But in the same footnote, the court indicated it did not agree with the government's suggestion that deciding either to offer a blanket license or to have only a single headwear license would not constitute concerted activity under that test. The court said those decisions by the members of the NFL would still involve decisions among potential competitors. And the court also said that even decision by the NFL properties would involve concerted action because the choice would be functionally made by the league teams. I think the Supreme Court indicated that the test proposed by the government would not be useful in establishing a bright line rule for discerning what is concerted activity, in large measure because I think the court wanted to back away from bright line rules, fearing that lower courts would, as the Seventh Circuit had, perhaps rely on them and make the wrong call in certain cases.
Well, I guess we'll see if Justice Kagan is going to be able to change that now that she's on the Supreme Court. I've often thought that the Supreme Court felt motivated to write on the topics that it did in American Needle because the lower courts were getting it slightly wrong and being somewhat permissive in finding an exemption from the antitrust laws when two companies got together and coordinated to achieve something that had a noble purpose. So the Supreme Court has righted that path with American Needle. But of interest to me is what have the lower courts done after American Needle? Have they accepted what the Supreme Court has done, or they tried to do something different? Maureen, do you have any idea of how lower courts have reacted to American Needle?
Well, we've had three Circuit Court of Appeal decisions that have cited American Needle, and three of those citations were by the Third Circuit. in the most important of the rulings, which was Deutsche Tennisbund versus ATP Tour, the Third Circuit cited American Needle in reviewing a jury instruction. Now, this case involved a charge that the Association of Tennis Professionals had violated Section 1 when it reorganized the ATP Tour and, among other things, downgraded the Hamburg, Germany Tour from a first-tier to second-tier status. The German Tennis Federation and other affected federations sued. At trial, the judge gave a single-entity instruction that stated where entities, quote, are commonly controlled or substantially integrated in their operations, they may be considered a single entity or single enterprise under the antitrust laws. The federations objected to the instruction, but the jury returned a verdict for ATP, finding on the Section 1 claims that the federations had not proven that the ATP had entered into any contracts, combinations, or conspiracies with any separate entity or entities. And the jury also found for ATP on the Section 2 claim because the federations had not proven the relevant product and geographic markets. Now, the Third Circuit found that the federations were required to prove the relevant market to prevail on their Section 1 claim because the rule of reason applied. And for that reason, the Third Circuit declined to decide if the single enterprise instruction given was erroneous because the Section 1 claim would still fail in light of the failure to prove the relevant market. But the court's opinion included a substantial discussion of concerted activity and American Needle's impact on that analysis. It noted the courts historically subjected sports leagues to antitrust scrutiny and that many courts had resisted applying the single entity doctrine to sports industries. And it noted that an agreement among the ATP members might have deprived the marketplace of potential competition because they competed for players. But the court didn't provide a definitive answer on whether or not the instruction was erroneous. I think there's every indication it believed it was, and frankly, I think they should have made clearer that the instruction was erroneous because it provided, at least as quoted by the Third Circuit, very little guidance on the issue of what constituted sufficient integration, even under the case law predating the American Needle decision. In another case, Race Tires America versus Hoosier Racing Tire Corporation, the Third Circuit upheld an exclusive equipment requirement adopted by several motorsports sanctioning bodies. That rule required participants in races to use a particular tire on their cars. The Third Circuit found the rule passed muster under the rule of reason and emphasized that it was not granting any kind of antitrust immunity, citing American Needle. There was another decision that cited it that's not particularly significant, and the Federal Circuit has cited American Needle for the rather unremarkable proposition that the rule of reason generally applies to joint ventures. So the circuit courts, at least, I think, are conscious of American Needle and will follow it, but we haven't had any explicit ruling on the contours of where at least the circuit courts think the single entity rule might still apply.
Thanks, Peter and Maureen. You have both spoken in great detail today regarding what the American Needle decision might mean to antitrust practitioners. But I think I'd like to conclude today's discussion with a question that is on the mind of sports fans. Peter, what might the court's ruling mean for the NFL, particularly in light of the fact that the league's collective bargaining agreement is due to expire at the end of the season?
Well, I think it's going to mean a lot, more from a practical standpoint than from a judicial standpoint. I think that from my looking at the blogs and the Internet, it seems like the players are somewhat excited about American Needle because they see a way around some of the rules and salary caps that exist out there. And I don't think that the players, well, let me put it differently. I think the players are going to be finding themselves reading too much into American Needle. I think that, as I said previously, there is an exemption for collective bargaining under the antitrust laws, and it was developed by the Supreme Court. And I think the NFL, as it goes into the collective bargaining process this fall, is going to rely very heavily on the fact that there is this exemption for collective bargaining. Now, whether it can get as far as it wants to get in pushing back the players' claims and demands, I think is not going to be so much a function of how American Needle is interpreted, but how much fortitude the owners have in order to push what they want in terms of the salary. The one thing that we can't forget is that American Needle did not hold that the NFL did anything wrong. It didn't criticize its activities other than to say that they're subject to Section 1. The Supreme Court made it very clear that it was up to the lower courts to decide whether or not the NFL violated Section 1. And it did give the NFL a bit of a leg up by recognizing that the leagues do need to get together to make professional football work under certain circumstances, and that as a result, the restraints that the NFL comes up with amongst the teams should be judged under the rule of reason. So it's not holding that even if the agreement were established in the lower court, that it's automatically illegal. The court's going to say, the Supreme Court said that what you need to do is examine it under the rule of reason. You weigh the pro-competitive against the anti-competitive, and you determine whether or not a violation has occurred. And that's what's going to generally occur in sports and otherwise. But, John, getting back to your question, I think the significance of American Needle is not so much in the legal ramifications, but in the practical ramifications and how much the players or the owners can make of it.
Thank you very much. This has been a very interesting discussion of the American Needle decision. And again, I'd like to thank both of you for your extensive thoughts on this case.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this LexisNexis Legal Podcast. Visit the LexisNexis communities at www.lexisnexis.com/community. The LexisNexis Corporate and Securities Law Community Podcast, copyright 2010 by LexisNexis, a division of Reed Elsevier Incorporated. LexisNexis, Total Practice Solutions.